You've tuned to the Turley Frequency, starring your host, Kevin Turley, with guest stars Mike Romano and Reed Hodges, and special guest stars, the members of the FCC, whom we respect respectfully. Now, time to get tuned into The Frequency. Call the show at 888-928-0881. That's 888-928-0881. Or text us at 251-928-2111. And now we cross live to the Archangel Radio Studios in downtown Fairhope to at last feel the Turley Frequency.
Hello and welcome to today's edition of the Turley Frequency, and I'm your host Kevin Turley, and for the next 2 hours I hope to entertain and elucidate in equal measure. Today on the show we meet the investigative journalist and author Isabel Vincent, and she'll be telling us all about the true story of two courageous sisters who became a rescue mission in the Third Reich in a tale that is described as Schindler's List meets The Sound of Music. We speak with the author in the next segment. Top of the hour, we pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and you are invited to join us. Feel free to text me your prayer requests on 251-928-2111. The lines are open for you right now. In the final segment today, we meet the architecture professor Tanya Unstadt, and she will be discussing all things architecture, and in particular, the Catholic University of America's latest project to rebuild an historic dome that can withstand extreme weather. I know, it sounds interesting. Well, you're going to have to stick around to the last segment to find out more. Okay, with all this good stuff, let's get this show on the road. Hello and welcome to Friday's edition of the Turley Frequency. So good to have your company on this Friday, the end of the week for many of us, the end of the working week, that is, in this month of July, a month dedicated to the precious blood, which we've spoken about and we will speak about again, no doubt. Now, as it's Friday here on the Turley Frequency, we look for the weird and the wonderful when it comes to news stories. And I did not have to look far this morning. Not at all. Now, do you remember a couple of weeks ago, we had our resident ufologist on, Bill Murphy, Bill from the Center for UFO Studies and the Anomalist and various other places. Bill is a mine of information about historical UFO crashes, landings, sightings, alleged sightings, abductions, you name it. UFOs, he's your man. And he's become a bit of a friend to the show. He's turned up a number of times, and he's always fascinating to talk with. Now, you may remember we had him on speed dial when the Pentagon whistleblower, David Grosh, hit the headlines a few weeks ago when he was talking about the U.S. government for many, many decades having retrieved alien craft and possessing such things in hangars, no doubt, around Area 51. So we asked Bill about that, and Bill and I were both a little bit skeptical, do you remember? Mr. Grosh's story seemed to grow as the week progressed. It moved from a sort of whistleblower saying that the U.S. government had retrieved craft to suddenly they had aliens, and then to an historical pinpointing of a crash in Italy in 1933 or thereabouts, in the time of Mussolini, and that somehow this was taken to the United States at the end of the Second World War. And perhaps the most outlandish, and we felt the most laughable claim of all, that the Vatican knew all about this, that Pope Pius XII was in on it, so to speak. Well, we laughed and we laughed. But this morning I saw something which I almost spurted my coffee out as I began to read it. And that is a story which is getting a lot of press over here. It comes from the Daily Mail. They have an exclusive, the British newspaper. And it's basically an Italian researcher who seems to have, or alleges to have, I should say, evidence for this 1933 UFO crash in Mussolini's Italy. That's right. Now, he claims that, and he was in an interview with the newspaper, the Daily Mail, it's a UFOlogist, yes, an Italian one, called Roberto Peniti. And he says that the fascist dictator Benito Mussolini got his hands on a flying saucer after it crashed on June 13th, 1933. But Panetti alleged that the alien craft was captured by advancing American forces at the end of the Second World War and shepherded over there in the full connivance of the U.S. government. And indeed, Mussolini. Well, I think Mussolini might have been dead by that stage, actually. Or perhaps he was, he was captured by the Germans and taken off. So anyway, we don't need to worry about Mussolini. The UFO craft, the alleged UFO craft, made its way to the United States, and allegedly it's still there today. Now, this Italian researcher has shown documents to the newspaper that claims that are evidence, or he claims they're evidence, of the crash and of a secret department set up by the Italian dictator Mussolini to study the alleged saucer. I'm going to give you a quote from this Mr. Panetti. I and my colleague Alfredo Lossini began investigating the story of the 1933 UFO crash in Lombardy in 1996 when we received some original secret documents about the case. Strange, no? I'm not sure what to really make of this. Because, as I said, the story, Grosch's story, the whistleblower story, got larger and larger as the week went on. And I'm not absolutely certain that that there was any truth to this. But we don't know whether the Italian ufologist has come out of the woodwork at this time to highlight what has happened and jump on the back of the whistleblower's claims. I mean, it's a convenient moment in which to discuss this with a British newspaper, which I'm sure paid a lot of money to get this exclusive. But am I being too cynical? Phone me and tell me. 888-928-0881. I'm not sure. He doesn't. I mean, to be fair, the Italian researcher doesn't mention the Vatican. He doesn't mention the Vatican. That was the American whistleblower who mentioned it. But it's an odd piece of information. I did look at some of the documentation that the Daily Mail was putting on its website. Go and look at it yourself in 2 minutes if you want. The trouble with documentation like this is that it is very hard to verify. And it would take a specialist who understands the texture of materials, paper materials used in official Italian government communications of the 1930s to be able to definitively say that the documentation that's alleged is just that. Because the one thing that I think we can all agree is that in the world of UFOs or UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena, as it's now called, there's a lot of hoax, counter hoax, claim, counterclaim, and the whole thing is really needing a great act of faith to actually believe in anything. But I thought it was really interesting that that story just happened to drop this morning. And now, just in case you were wondering about the man behind this, he's actually given an interview now, David Grosch, to an Australian television company. And we're just going to play a little bit of his voice because I think, I don't know about you, I'd like to watch the whole video. And I know there's various body language experts have been studying this man because he could be a total charlatan or he could be one of the most interesting people in the United States today. We just don't know. So let's have a listen to Dave Grosch, the man who is blowing the whistle on the Pentagon's secret UFO retrievals.
These are retrieving non-human origin technical vehicles, you know, call it spacecraft if you will, non-human, exotic origin vehicles that have either landed or crashed.
We have spacecraft from another species.
We do, yeah.
How many?
Quite a number.
You're kidding.
No. When you recover something that's either landed or crashed, sometimes you encounter dead pilots. And believe it or not, as fantastical as that sounds, it's true.
Well, that is fantastical. And I loved the reaction of the interviewer, the Australian interviewer. You're kidding. Now, you're kidding is a very British Australian way of reacting to something which is outlandish. But in this case, I think you're kidding may be the appropriate response to this. The thing that struck me most was the seriousness and the earnestness with which his interviewee was setting this out. Also, like his original story, it was all a little bit vague from the bits I saw. You know, he's talking about a number of craft. There's no details of how many. Nothing is detailed. There's nothing factual. It's all a little bit sort of sensational and vague enough for people to join the dots in their minds. Anyway, we'll leave it there for the moment. That is, well, this is an ongoing story. Obviously, the Pentagon has completely refuted all of these claims. The Daily Mail, at the very bottom of the article, reached out to the Pentagon and they said they have no knowledge of retrieved Italian craft from the 1930s that were secretly shepherded over to the United States at the end of the Second World War. But they would say that, wouldn't they? Okay, now some more interesting stuff here on planet Earth. Do you remember yesterday I was talking about Pay It Forward? Do you remember we were talking about those two stories about very good-hearted United people in the United States? Do you remember the ferry passenger worker who took all of the stranded ferry passengers home, all 10 of them, much to his wife's joy, I'm sure? And the young man who worked in a fast food restaurant on an interstate who decided to pay for a man embarrassed by the fact that his credit card had declined his transaction. And he said, don't worry about it, I've got it. And this went viral, and this young man is now, you know, rightly lauded as a good-spirited citizen from Tennessee. But we talked about this idea of pay it forward, which I was saying I'd never really heard before until yesterday. And it just so happens that it links very nicely with the latest news about what we were talking about this day last week. If you remember, we had our Hollywood reporter on, Robert Brennan. And he was talking about the new film, The Sound of Freedom. Now, I still have The Sound of Freedom on my computer. I have a screener from the company to watch. I'm building up the strength to watch it. It just doesn't feel like a sort of weekend film. Do you know what I mean? A film about child trafficking, sex trafficking. I'd rather say a Decade of the Rosary for that intention rather than watch it. But I'm all in favor of the film. And so it seems is the United States, because I checked the box office receipts. Now, do you remember Sound of Freedom rightly was released on the great day of freedom, which is, of course, the 4th of July, the day of independence. And it was released on that day alongside and competing with the likes of Indiana Jones and The Dial of Destiny. I think it's the fifth and final episode of the Indiana Jones what would you call it, saga, and Harrison Ford is still playing a 40-year-old, even though he is twice that in real life. And at the same time, there was Walt Disney releasing Elemental, a film with gender-fluid characters. Beware, you have been warned. Spider-Man, Transformers, and all the usual, you know this sort of thing. Anyway, Sound of Freedom debuted at number one. That's right, number one. And I was just checking the box office figures. It recouped $14+ million in one day. Now, just to give you an idea of what that looks like, how good that was, Indiana Jones was bumped from spot one to spot two by Sound of Freedom and was only managing to get box office on that day of $11.6 million. And Elemental, the gender-fluid Disney movie, could only scrape through $2 million plus on the 4th of July. So Sound of Freedom was way, way out in front. And it's a big congratulations to everybody involved in the making of that film. Now, just to give you some idea, you know, what these box office figures mean. Box office figures are only as good as the budget you're working to. Do you remember we talked about this? So a film like Indiana Jones and also the Disney, I mean, the Disney one, for example, I'm almost certain had a a budget of around about $200 million. And the reason I say that is because it was about $100 million to make and $100 million to market, something like that. And it's a long way off, even yet, from recouping its money and going into profit. Remember, it has to gain all that money back before you see any profits. And Indiana Jones, I haven't checked the figures for that, but you can imagine what they're like. They're the usual many, many millions. But let's look at Sound of Freedom. Sound of Freedom, the budget, they reckon, was about $14.5 million. $14.5 million, which is a modest box office, right? Well, on that one day alone, the 4th of July, and it means it subsequently also regained some money through box office receipts, but just on this day, focusing on the 4th of July, it almost just missed recouping its whole budget in one day. Now, that's a huge success for a movie. And it is a particularly apt success for a movie like this, which has a very good message, which others don't want it to broadcast. Remember, we talked about the way in which Disney had bought the movie back in 2018 and then managed to shelve it for years. And it took a sort of crowdsourcing campaign by the producers to get this movie out to the US public, and that it has done in grand style. So we're applauding Sound of Freedom and the fact that they will now very easily recoup their budget and hopefully make a lot more money. Some of the projections looked at is that the film would make at least twice its budget, if not more. And that is a huge vote of confidence, not just in the movie, but also in the people behind it, the people who Angel Studios, the people who have helped distribute this movie to the US public. Now, why am I talking about pay it forward? Well, part of the pay it forward idea is Angel Studios' idea, whereby people can buy tickets for other people, right? So moviegoers purchase tickets for other people whom they want to see Sound of Freedom. And this is the first time they've launched it. They launched it last month, or in March 2023, with a film called His Only Son, which you can imagine what that's about. And now they have tried it out with Sound of Freedom. And they found that they sold, get this, $2.5 million worth of tickets on the Pay It Forward. Now, I don't know about you, but I think this is a great idea. I think this is a wonderful way in which people can empower other people and enable other people to go and enjoy really good entertainment. And it really does my heart good to see a film like this achieve what it has at the box office. If you are looking for a film this weekend and you are strong enough to take it, Sound of Freedom might be the movie for you. Now, talking of freedoms, yesterday we talked about the Precious Blood and the month of July, and I came across a really interesting story. Now, the story is from last year, but never mind. You probably won't have heard it. And it involves a theft. It involves the theft of a medieval reliquary from a French church, a church in Normandy. We were discussing St. Therese the other day, and she is a great patron of Normandy. Anyway, thieves went into the French church, and they ransacked it, and they stole this medieval reliquary. What is a reliquary? Well, a reliquary is something which holds often a very precious relic of a saint. Except in this case, the church's relic was that of the Precious Blood. Right? Precious Blood. I know. A church called the Holy Trinity Abbey in the town of Fécamp, in Normandy, France. Anyway, the story took on a really bizarre twist because the church and the French authorities, the French police, put out information that this was a very precious, it was beyond value. Nobody could sell it because it was so precious. But also they talked about the religious significance of it and the precious blood. So what happened? Well, the thieves contacted a Dutch detective who specializes in these type of medieval thefts. And they said they wanted to get rid of the reliquary. They wanted to hand it back as soon as possible. They couldn't cope with having it any longer. So much was the guilt upon their consciences. But they would only give it back to him on one condition, that they could literally drop it somewhere and then disappear. So he agreed. Now, the criminals did say that if he didn't agree to this, they would destroy the reliquary. So there was no choice. The detective had to say, okay. So one night, the bell rang at his home in Holland, and he went to the door, and there was a box sitting there, and the reliquary was inside. And it was really interesting what the Dutch policeman said, because he had a few days where he held on to this reliquary, and he said it was a really interesting experience in the house, having this precious thing. Remember, imagine in your home having something holding the precious blood. Can you imagine that? Anyway, it said that he was on his best behavior for a few days, and he is a religious man, and he said he prayed every night with it. And then he handed it back to the French authorities, who duly brought it back to Normandy, where it was once more installed in the Holy Trinity Church. But just makes you think, doesn't it, about the power of the precious blood. But then again, maybe not. Remember the original crucifixion? There were some thieves there as well, and they both recognized who was the Son of God. One of them rejected him, but one of them accepted him and gained paradise as a result. Okay, when we come back, we're going to be meeting Isabel Vincent, who is a best-selling author and investigative reporter, and she's going to be telling us a very interesting story about how two British women saved many Jewish opera stars during the Second World War. Stay tuned to the Charlie Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. Welcome back to the Charlie Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. It really is good to have your company on this Friday. It's Friday, so you can relax. Now, one of the things we've been doing in the last few weeks on Friday is looking for good summer reads. And we've had various people on from both publishers, writers, readers, and they've all been giving us their two penneth worth, which is the British way of saying their 2 cents for what they consider would be a good read for the audience. So my next guest may just have an opinion on that because she's an author, and she may also just have the book for us this summer. She is Isabel Vincent, an award-winning investigative reporter who has broken stories on Chinese police operations in New York City and Black Lives Matter's financial dealings or misdealings. She's a graduate of the University of Toronto and began her career at Canada's Globe and Mail. But today, she is a staff reporter with the New York Post. As if all that was not enough, she is also the author of 7 non-fiction books, including Hitler's Silent Partners, Swiss Banks, Nazi Gold, and The Pursuit of Justice, and more recently a book that is described by the publishers as Schindler's List meets The Sound of Music. And that book is Overture of Hope, Two Sisters' Daring Plan That Saved Opera's Jewish Stars from the Third Reich. This book tells the amazing story of two British spinsters who masterminded a plan to save from the Third Reich dozens of Jewish opera stars and personnel by helping them escape to England. And the author of this tale joins me down the line this morning. Isabel, welcome to the Charlie Frequency.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Pleasure having you on. Now, first of all, the question that comes to mind, having written a few books myself, I'm wondering, where did you come across this story?
So a friend of mine went to Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, which is the Holocaust memorial, and saw the trees that were planted in the honor of Ida and Louise Cook, the two sisters. And he was like, I've never heard of these women, and I've never heard of this story, and it's incredible. So they were made righteous among the nations in Israel. They're made righteous Gentiles in 1965, around the same time that Raoul Wallenberg and Oskar Schindler were given the distinction. And everybody knows, you know, everybody knows those names, but you don't know the names of Ida and Louise Cook. And what they did was you know, just as heroic. They were these ordinary, extraordinary women, clerks in the law courts in London, who became just very devoted opera fans. I mean, today we would call them opera groupies, and mm-hmm. befriended all of these big stars of the day, including Viennese conductor Clemens Krauss, who was Hitler's favorite conductor. So that's a very important part of this story. Like, Hitler set him up at the Munich Opera, gave him an unlimited budget to put on operas. And at the same time, he's helping, or he's asking Ida and Louise to please help him save some of his Jewish musicians and opera scholars. And this is the incredible part of the story. I mean,
we've got time this morning, Isabel. So let's unpack it a little bit, if you don't mind. I mean, because it sounds absolutely fascinating. And you probably know I'm speaking to you from London, so my ears are pricking up the minute you mention Ida and Louise and where they worked and where they lived. I mean, they were living in 1930s London, which probably wouldn't. I mean, there were operas, obviously, and there still are opera houses here today. But the connections between the continent and England at that time, for ordinary people, they would not have been the norm. Were these exceptional women? Were they people who traveled across Europe simply to indulge their love of opera?
Not only traveled across Europe, but actually made this incredible voyage to New York City at the end of 1926, early 1927, to hear a soprano, an Italian soprano named Amalie Tagliacorci, who they befriended backstage at the Royal Albert Hall after one of her concerts. And they, you know, sort of shyly asked her, well, we'd really love to hear you sing opera. And she said, well, I only do opera at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. So Ida and Louise said, okay, we're going to go there. And it took them 2 years to save their money to buy a passage, a ship's passage to New York, and stay for a few weeks. And at the time, Amalie Tagliacorci said, well, if you make it to New York, I will give you all of the tickets to my performances for free. And so it was such a big deal that they did this, that on the ship over to New York City, they spoke to their fellow passengers. One of them contacted the New York Times. And all of a sudden, they're on the front page of the Times for having undertaken this, you know, crazy journey. And it's they're immortalized in the first paragraph that goes something like this. Ida and Louise Cook, two members of the working girl class, blonde, made this incredible trip to New York City to hear opera. And the reason I mention that trip is because it shows their intrepid nature. Like, when it came to opera, nothing would stop them. So to answer your question, nothing stopped them from going onto the European continent at a time of great instability. We're talking about like 1934, to attend opera performances.
Now, you've said that they worked in the courts. I mean, these were the sort of classic case of two sisters who had this kind of probably sort of matter-of-fact lifestyle. Probably their neighbors thought that they did an ordinary job, had a very quiet lifestyle. And yet in the background, they had this sort of heroic, epic sort of journey that was part of their life. Just tell our audience a little bit about what the public view of their life was, what they did, where they lived, that sort of thing.
So they lived with their parents their entire life. They were, you know, part of the, I mean, they called themselves spinsters, and they talked about coming of age at a time when they were known as surplus women, because they came of age after the First World War that saw something like the deaths of 750,000 British men. Outwardly, they seemed very ordinary, although Ida, in about 1936, had the chance to become a romance novelist, and she ended up writing 200 romance novels under the pseudonym Mary Birchall. And that's what, you know, that sort of coincided with their work saving people from the Third Reich. But it's very interesting that outwardly they seemed very sort of boring and normal, but they did live these like incredible lives of sort of daring and heroics. And they also lived that through the opera. So they, you know, the melodrama of the opera and through Ida's books. So yes, on the surface, they seemed very ordinary, but underneath they were anything but.
And just for anybody listening who doesn't know, when you say that Ida was a novelist, a romance novelist, she wrote for something which is very, very big in the UK. It's called Mills and Boon. And Mills and Boon have been for decades the purveyors of romantic fiction. And they sell hundreds of thousands of these titles. I mean, this is a big marketing ploy, and they have a big audience for it. So Ida would have been somebody who was there are often people who write under aliases and pen names for various reasons. So Ida would have had a huge audience. But it also gives us an insight, does it not, Isabel, into something of the kind of romance of what her and her sister were involved in. I mean, this was something beyond the ordinary that they were keen to get involved in.
Yes, that's certainly true. And when I asked people who remembered Ida and Louise, you know, I said, well, why did they do this? And a lot of people answered, like, I was surprised by the answer. A lot of people said that they were both madly in love with Clemens Krauss, the Austrian conductor, and they would have done anything he asked. So, I mean, sort of madly in love from afar, you know, but that was really sort of an impetus of, I mean, once they discovered what was going on with Jews in the Third Reich, I mean, they really felt that they needed to help. I mean, they were so outraged by, you know, the erosion of their rights under the Nuremberg laws, and it took them a while to figure it out. You know, they had to go to Germany and talk to people because they just, you know, if you're like a civil servant in the UK and you believe in jurisprudence and, you know, freedom of speech and all this stuff, like you're going to a place where a sector of society is being denied that, and their rights are being taken away from them, at first slowly and then very quickly. So when they came to realize that, they were just all in, and it didn't matter. They didn't think about the danger. They just did what they had to do.
And how would you describe their motivation, Isabel? I mean, were they politically motivated, philosophically? Were they sort of proto-feminists, or were they deeply religious people? I mean, what was the motivation here to help their fellow human beings?
I think Ida addresses that in her book. They were just, you know, they were Church of England taught to help their fellow man in need, and grew up with that in a household where their father was essentially a tax collector, and they grew up all over England with this sense of responsibility to the people around them. So I think that was a great motivator. I, you know, call it religious, call it, you know, sort of this this family legacy that they grew up with, but presented with, you know, the situation that they were presented with, it never entered their minds to say no. And Ida actually dedicates her memoir. She published a memoir about her sort of opera dealings, and that touches on her relief work as well in 1950, dedicating it to her parents, and saying, you know, without their example of, you know, sort of responsibility to humanity, they never would have done this. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I think that's what motivated them. It's like they came from that kind of background.
It does answer my question, Isabel, but the more I hear about these two sisters, the more I am intrigued, which is a good sign for you and for your book. So I'm in conversation with Isabel Vincent here this morning, who's an investigative journalist, and she's done some investigating with these two sisters who undermined the Nazi attempt to exterminate Jews during the Second World War, and especially those involved in the world of opera. And we'll continue this conversation when we come back. Stay tuned to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel. Welcome back to the Turley Frequency here, live and exclusive on Archangel Radio. I'm in fascinating conversation with Isabel Vincent. She is an award-winning investigative reporter with the New York Post, but she's also a best-selling author and has just published, or last year or so published, a book called The Overture of Hope, Two Sisters' Daring Plan That Saved Opera's Jewish Stars from the Third Reich. Now, Isabel, I hope you won't be offended by my next question, but I was reading the blurb from your publishers about this book, and they were setting it up nicely. They were describing a sort of dowdy typist, which was a bit unfair in one of the sisters, and then another sister who's a sort of fantasy romantic fiction writer type thing. And it did cross my mind. Did the sisters realize what they were getting into? Were they really aware of the dangers both to themselves and to the people that they were helping?
Not at the beginning. Again, you know, it was like this slow realization of what, you know, what they were doing. Like they, at the beginning, they just said, you know, when they were faced with their first refugee, if they will, they had never met a Jew before. The would-be refugee comes to London on a supposedly a business trip, but she's really trying to scout out. She's an opera scholar and a music teacher, and she's trying to scout out, you know, a place to go because things are getting worse for her. She's been kicked out of the Frankfurt Conservatory because she's Jewish. Her husband's business has been Aryanized. So Ida and Louise sort of take her under their wing, and they – you know, they're asked by the conductor's wife, Viorica Ursuliak, who was a soprano and a brilliant soprano in her own right. They're asked by her to please take care of Mitya Meyer-Leisman, who is the woman who came to see them in London in about 1935 or so. They're asked to take care of her. So they take her on a tour of, you know, the sites in London, and they go to all of these churches, and Ida at one point asks her, tell me, are you Protestant or Catholic? And Mitya Meyer-Leisman looks at them and says, oh, I thought you knew, I'm Jewish. So it's the first Jew they've met, and then they hear her story, and Ida says over coffee, well, we'll just have to come to Frankfurt and figure this out. And they do, but as they get deeper into the refugee work, they certainly realize the dangers they're facing. And at one point, Ida goes to Frankfurt on her own after Kristallnacht, after November 1938.
Which, just in case anybody's not aware, Isabel, is the night when the Nazis really overtly attacked Jewish businesses, synagogues. Kristallnacht was the night when the glass shattered, so to speak.
Exactly. So Ida goes on her own, and it's significant that she goes on her own because during the time, like after meeting Mitya Meyer-Leisman and realizing the task in front of them, Louise, the older sister, decides she's German so that she can speak to the refugees in German. And Ida doesn't speak German, so she's on her own with her blue British passport, as she says, that if war breaks out between Germany and the United States, Germany and the UK, that she's pretty much on her own and will probably be rounded up and put in a concentration camp, and nobody will be able to help her. So she does realize sort of by, you know, as she moves forward in this, that yes, it's very dangerous what they were doing. But at the beginning, they didn't think it through.
No, I don't. But I don't suppose anybody does in a situation like that. I mean, they were confronted with a problem, with a human need, and the instinct of most ordinary people is to want to help somebody. But they had a very unusual way of helping it. Now, the way they wanted to help people, though, also sort of coincided with their great passion in life, which was the opera, right?
Exactly. So what would happen is that Clemens Krauss would put on operas on the weekend, and it was on the weekend because Louise, remember, is a full-time civil servant. Ida has since left her job in the law courts and now is writing fiction full time. But still, you know, they had the weekends to go to the opera performance. That became the pretext for their trip. So when they were asked at, you know, at the border, what were they doing in Austria and Germany in those years, they would say, we're going to the opera. And they had this military exercise set up where they would go in by one border. So they would take a plane to Cologne and they would come back, you know, through Holland by train. I mean, they never took the same way in and out on, you know, on the weekends. And they would also collect the jewelry of the people, these would-be refugees. So just to explain that if you were a Jew, you were still allowed to leave the Third Reich in the years before the war, before 1939, provided you surrendered all of your assets. So what a lot of people would do is buy jewelry, buy things that were easily transportable. And a lot of the people that the Cooks helped entrusted them with their jewelry. And so the way that the Cook sisters would take the jewelry across the border was just to plaster it all over their Marks and Spencer or, you know, dresses.
Just for anybody who's listening, Marks and Spencer's just your average dress, okay, worn by average people, mass marketed, nothing special. So people, I presume the Nazi border guards would have just thought they were paste. They were not the real thing, right?
Exactly. I mean, and think about the sort of the confidence to do that. and they would also, I mean, you know, sometimes they had so much jewelry that their purses would be filled with it. And if they were ever caught, Ida, you know, had the perfect excuse. She would just say, she called it, they would break it into their nervous British spinster act and say, well, yes, we're going to the opera and we need to take all our jewelry because we don't trust anybody in London to look after it. Do you have a problem with that? So they did this over and over again and were never caught. And then also they would bring out people's women's fur coats, which were also a sort of easily transportable luxury item. But what they would do is once they arrived in either Munich, Berlin, or Vienna, wherever they were going to the opera, they came armed with labels of British fur coats. Like they would actually, on the streets of London, if they saw a woman with a fur coat, they would ask if they could rip out the label. So they took the labels, they ripped out the German or the Austrian label in the coat, and they would sew in the British label. And they would do this right away when they arrived. And then they would wear the fur coats into the hotels where they were staying so that it appeared to be their stuff. I mean, they really, if you think about it, they really worked this out. The only thing that they refused to transport were earrings for pierced ears because they didn't have pierced ears. And at one point, Louise said the thought of, you know, piercing our ears was just too horrible, you know, even to do this. So imagine, like, they're risking their lives, but they can't pierce their ears
But surely, Isabel, it's that sort of little human touch in your researches which really brings these women to life. You know, I mean, you're doing it now as you're speaking. These women are really coming to life in front of us. But to answer me this, because we haven't got very, very much longer, and people can go and read the book, Overture of Hope, Two Sisters, Daring Plan That Saved Opera's Jewish Stars from the Third Reich. You really sold it well to us, Isabel. It sounds like an absolutely fascinating story on many different different levels. But answer me this in your researches, because sometimes when I've read stories of people who have had what they describe over here as a good war, i.e. a war where they were, their lives were suddenly transformed and they had a life that they could never have imagined. Post-war, things don't always work out. There's an element of anticlimax sometimes. Yes, they survived the war and they're grateful for that, but they've still got often many, many decades ahead of them. How did it work out for the two sisters?
So they never stopped their relief work. They, after the war, after they'd saved 29 people, they started volunteering at displaced persons camps in Germany and, you know, helping people get their lives together, even with their own refugees, as they called them, in London. When people fell on hard times, they came back to the Cook sisters and they loaned them money. Their first refugee, Mietje Meyer-Liesman, lost her job in London at a sort of elite private school or public school, as you would say, and went back to live in the Cooks' flat. So the Cooks rented a flat in central London for their opera parties, but it later became the clearinghouse, as Ida called it, for their refugees. At one point during the war, there were 15 people living in a one-bedroom apartment. So Ida allowed the refugees, when they fell on hard times, to go back to that apartment and get their lives back in order. So their help never stopped.
Wonderful. And of course, then they were recognized by the State of Israel as Righteous Gentiles, which was the highest award for those that helped during the Second World War. One last question, Isabel. How come this isn't a movie?
One hopes that it will be a movie, right? I mean, I think it's very cinematic and it would be a good vehicle for two great actresses. There's been talks about the film, but so far, you know, nothing, you know, we don't have a date, we don't have anything very concrete, but I don't understand how Hollywood works, but I think it's a slow process. But yes, one day I hope it will be, because I fell in love with Ida and Louise. I, you know, their story for me was just so brilliant. I mean, ordinary, extraordinary women.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, partly because of that and because of the climate, I'm surprised that this hasn't been picked up as a property and is being developed as we speak, if by the BBC, if nothing else. In terms of your day job as investigative reporting and doing some very fine work with the New York Post, is writing books like this, is this a kind of busman's holiday, as we call it over here, a bit of a work relief?
In a way, I mean, I spent 5 years on this book because I went through so many different archives, but I'm really passionate about the story. And with my books, you know, I've tried to focus on sort of women lost to history in a way and bringing them to life, bringing like extraordinary stories to life is a real passion. So I don't even consider it work. I'm just really lucky that I can make a living. I mean, I can't make a living writing books, but I can make a living doing, you know, sort of one, you know, sort of the day job helps with the passion projects. And I'm just really grateful that I'm able to do this.
Well, just wait till Hollywood starts calling, Isabel, then you'll never have to work again. Listen, tell people where they can find out more about you and where they can also pick up a copy of Overture of Hope.
The book is being sold pretty much everywhere. Amazon, bookstores should have it. In the UK, you know, I'm pretty sure you can order it off Amazon.
You can.
There's no British edition yet. Fingers crossed. But yeah, pretty much everywhere books are sold, and my stuff's in the New York Post on a regular basis. So if you just go to the website and put in my name, you will see everything I've done.
Isabel, thank you so much for taking time this morning just speaking to us from New York City.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. It's a real honor. Thank you.
Okay, when we come back, we'll be speaking to the Lord. We'll be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay tuned to the Telefrequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio.